disease. The environment of freedom has caused the greatest leap ever in our human well-being, not just for America. Our ideas and innovations here are seen almost immediately and replicated even in third world and developing nations. You can go to the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere, Haiti, and you'll see cell phones by impoverished people all across the world, because impoverished people want a leg up too. You see, trickle-down does work. When you have innovation, when you have growth, when you have new wealth that's created, it's those at the bottom of the economic ladder who have the most to gain. Because the environment of freedom has created the greatest leap ever in human well-being, improving our lives by an order of magnitude. It represents the opportunity to thrive, regardless of age or race or gender. The recipe for success is simple. Encourage work. Don't discourage it. That's what England recently found. Embrace human creativity and human capital. Don't limit it. Expand freedom for people to follow their dreams. Don't stop people from the benefit of failure. Because those who overcome failure ultimately learn how to succeed. And here's just one example. I'm a former federal tax lawyer, and I know firsthand that our tax code has become too complex, too unfair, and blatantly a tool for political cronyism and control. That's what lobbyists are all about. We need a flatter, fairer tax system that levels the playing field for everyone, that encourages innovation and growth, and stops taxing investment and productivity. Last year saw the 100th anniversary of the United States Federal Income Tax Code. Hardly something to celebrate. Just go back down a trip on memory lane. In 1913, the top tax bracket in the United States, this is how the tax code was sold, it was going to be a 7% tax rate, and the tax code was 400 pages long. 100 years later, the top tax rate bracket has now ballooned to nearly 40%. That excludes state and local taxes. Excuse me, and the tax code today is over 74,000 pages long. And that doesn't include the rules and the regs. I just returned from speaking at the Reagan Ranch Center in California. I had the privilege to speak to a wonderful group of young conservative women. When Ronald Reagan came into office in 1980, the top tax rate was, hold on to your seats, 70%. Sound like France? Not working so well for them. It didn't work so well for the United States either. But by the time Ronald Reagan left office, our top tax rate dropped from 70% down to 28%. He also secured a 25% across-the-board reduction in income taxes for all Americans in every tax bracket, and he simplified the tax code from 16 brackets down to 2. In addition to cutting taxes, he also reduced spending. He reduced regulations, and he maintained a That's what a long airplane ride will do for you. Sorry. And he maintained a strong U.S. dollar. That's the winning formula for strong economic growth, no matter how you cut it. The result was 92 consecutive months of economic growth, the longest peacetime expansion in American history. And as we saw from Reagan's example, what drives innovation ultimately and growth is a free market enterprise environment that fosters it. Today, too many of our policies and institutions are on the opposite end of free market spectrum. One example in the news recently, coming from the financial services sector, is this: the Export-Import Bank. It doesn't sound terribly sexy, but it overwhelmingly subsidizes the most politically connected corporations in the world. Last year, a handful of Fortune 500 companies received more than half of the bank's financing. Nobody would care if this was a private bank, but this is a government subsidy. It amounts to cronyism that's financed by tax dollars and puts American small businesses at a competitive disadvantage. Do you see what I mean when I say that government is lifting up the big at the expense of the small, enabling the rich at the expense of the poor? That's not what government is supposed to do. It's time to let the free market work and allow the Export-Import Bank to expire. We can and we must advance opportunity for all Americans without giving special handouts to the select few. After 6 years of Barack Obama's presidency, it's no wonder that the American people feel this is a government for government, not a government for people. And I believe that President Obama's lasting legacy will be that the American people saw what a lawless presidency looks like, what big government overreach looks like, and the American people are going to say, nah, I think I'll take a rain check. President Obama set out to make government cool again, and he did just the opposite. The principles that make America an exceptional nation are too valuable to throw by the wayside. These principles are what will allow America to shine as the enduring beacon of freedom and liberty around the world. The Tea Party awakened the country to the values that we hold dear and that have made us the greatest nation in the world. The Tea Party embodies the revolutionary American spirit that rises up in each of us when our freedoms and our rights are being taken away. It's this spirit that built the nation from the bottom and up. It didn't build us from the top down. America hasn't been preserved by officials here in Washington, D.C. As much as we would like to see it, it isn't. It's been preserved by the men and the women who rose to the challenge and made the nation great, the Norman Borlaugs of the world, the Martin Luther King Juniors of the world, and the Elie Wiesels. From George Washington's ragtag army, who crossed the Delaware fearlessly in a blizzard, to the pioneers who crossed our continent in covered wagons to settle the American West, to the freedom-seeking immigrants who cross oceans to claim the promise of America's ideals. That's what keeps us rich and strong. It was the faith and spirit of our citizens, along with an opportunity for a better life, that built the country and made it great. Freedom and opportunity, they aren't political. They're not Republican and they're not Democrat. They're American values. But if we don't stand up to defend these ideals, then who will? In the last few years, it was the Tea Party, the squeaky little voice of the Tea Party that said, I will. I'll stand up. I'll defend these great enshrined American values. They've been the last line of defense to stand in the way of an ever-expanding government that taxes us too much, that regulates us too much, that spends too much, and is trying to extinguish one liberty of the American people after another. The Tea Party will never be content to let the principles of American greatness slip away. And with 2 more years of President Obama's pen and phone yet to come, contend for them we must. I thank you, and God bless you, and God bless the United States. Do you have any questions? Yeah. Happy to do it. Do you want me to sit down or stand?
We have time for a couple of questions. Let me maybe kick things off. Since you're not going to be around, maybe we can get to this. Let me put this in policy terms. Assuming the elections go the way people are talking about, you maintain the House, maybe gain the Senate, there will be this battle that comes up all the time with the Republicans and Democrats, too. Do we go sort of small ball and get a few things done to show we can get some things done? Or do they go after some big ideas and, you know, do something like the Ex-Im Bank or a pipeline or some issue like that? What would your advice be to the leadership? Because I'm sure you're giving it privately. What would your advice to the leadership be of how to manage that? And how would the Tea Party react to those kind of situations?
That's a great question. If everyone heard the question, it was fundamentally this. If the Republicans have both the House and the Senate this year, what is it that Republicans in Congress should do from a policy standpoint? Should they go small ball or should they go big ball? Well, I've only had one lever in my life. It's either on or off. You either go bold or you don't go at all. And when I came to Congress, I decided to take the dice and roll them. and give it everything I had. Because I had been a mom at home. I have 5 biological kids. We were privileged to raise 23 great foster kids in our home. When I was a mom around the kitchen table, listening to the radio or watching TV, looking at what was going on in faraway D.C., my opinion was this: what's wrong with these people? Don't they know how we live? Don't they understand what it's like to raise a family? We had our own little struggling small business. Don't they know what it's like for us? We just want to create jobs. We just want to grow. We just want to live. We just want a better life like our parents and grandparents did. So I say now and always, it isn't about D.C. It isn't about politicians. It's about finally getting your act together and listening to the American people and recognizing that the world isn't stagnant. Things are changing. We've got to do what we can so that the United States maintains its position as the economic powerhouse of the world. Because when we are the economic powerhouse of the world, then we can also be the military powerhouse of the world. The world is a safer place and better off when America is strong on both of those levels, economically and militarily. And what's phenomenal about this great American experiment in liberty is that it's all rest upon maximum liberty for the individual. What country does that? Only us. Only America does that. Lifts up the greatest amount of liberty for the individual, and shazam, you have the greatest country in the world that's also the powerhouse. You don't do that with small ball ideas. You do that with big ball ideas, like beginning with the tax code. You change it now, immediately, and you either go with a flat tax or you go with a national consumption tax. You figure out which one. I'll lead the debate. You want somebody to lead the debate? I'll lead the debate. Lead the debate and do it, because guess what, folks? This isn't working. America's foreign policy isn't working. Literally thousands of innocent people across the world are getting killed, including women and children who were buried alive in August by the Islamic State. You see, there are consequences when we are not strong. And that's why I say we don't have time to play around. Now is the time to reclaim greatness. And you don't do it by dribs and drabs. You do it by bold moves. Do you have compromise to get there? Yes, you do. Not your values, not your principles, but you get there.
Good. Thank you. Okay, we have a microphone here. Please use the microphone.
Hi, Congressman Bachman. I just want to say what a hero you are to the silent majority, the Christian coalition, or just mainstream America. And my question is, I just got back from Southern California, which, as you know, is run by the Democratic Party. And between that and the SEIU and the undocumented immigrants, I just want to know if those of you in Congress realize that I hope you do not, if you pass that. As according to Walter Moore, who's a candidate for mayor in Los Angeles, said that Southern California does look like a third world dump, and that's what it's becoming. And hope you, those of you in Congress, realize that if you pass immigration reform, that's what this America will head towards, unfortunately. I just want to know what you have to say about that.
Well, thank you for your question. I think no human being ever would be considered a dump. That would never happen. All human beings have worth and all human beings have value. When it comes to the issue of immigration, I think the most cynical move was made by the President of the United States. When the President of the United States announced publicly that, yes, he was going to, by himself, unilaterally grant amnesty to potentially millions of people illegally here in the United States, presumably some of them could be terrorists that are in the United States who illegally have come across our southern border. That's one of our greatest fears. We don't know, but that's one of our greatest fears today. He could be granting millions of work permits, effective amnesty, but He's going to wait until after the election, just like he's going to do with not publishing how much Obamacare premiums are going to go up until after the election. Let me say this about immigration. I spent 4 days on the southern border. I've looked at this issue and studied it a lot. I thought I knew a lot about this issue until I went to America's southern border. I drove from the mouth of the Rio Grande at Boca Chica all the way to Laredo. And what I learned was this. It was shocking. The Border Patrol doesn't stop anyone from coming into the United States. And it's not their fault. It's the politician's fault. Any foreign national who wants to come across our southern border comes in. They don't all get to stay necessarily, but they definitely get to come in. America is the most generous nation in the world when it comes to immigration. We allow in legally over 1 million people from across the world every year, legally. If you took every other country of the world and you took the number of people they allow in through immigration and you added up every other country of the world, every country of the world together doesn't equal what the United States allows in immigration in 1 year. And we're not the most populated nation in the world. We are an amazingly generous country, and immigration is good for the United States. We're a nation of immigrants. That doesn't include the number of illegal immigrants who come into the United States every year. Illegal immigration is estimated between an additional 1 to 2 million per year. That's an enormous amount of people. We've had great waves of immigration into the United States, but then we've also hit the pause button so we had time to assimilate. We may be at that point now. Calvin Coolidge did that in the 1920s. He hit the pause button, and we had a period of time where we dealt with assimilation. What is very different now from previous waves of immigration is today we have open borders combined with a welfare state. We didn't have that prior to 1965. That has changed our equation. So you can't talk about immigration without talking about America's current welfare state, because those are two issues that come together.
Yes, Leah Schwarting from Talk Radio News. What I wanted to ask is, I know that a little bit ago you were talking about introducing legislation to help ban people who have Western passports from entering America who had fought with the Islamic State. I was wondering if you'd talk a bit about the latest on that.
Thank you. That's a great question. I just returned from the Middle East, and it is very concerning what is going on. And I confirmed when I was in Europe with our FBI and our Department of Homeland Security a scenario that I find quite concerning. And it's one that I think it would offend the average American person. I come from a state, just by way of background, I come from Minnesota, a state with a tragic nexus to terrorism. We have the only convicted terrorists from 9-1-1. We have we've had over 50 leave Minnesota to join al-Shabaab, an affiliate of al-Qaeda. They've gone and strapped suicide vests onto themselves, and they've killed themselves fighting for al-Shabaab. We've had 4 cases of foreign terrorism financing. We've also had over 20 Minnesotans leave Minnesota to join and fight on behalf of the Islamic State. The first 2 Americans who were killed fighting for the Islamic State were Minnesota. We've recently had 3 young women, 19-year-old girls from St. Paul, Minnesota, go to join the Islamic State. We have a tragic nexus to terrorism. And so as I saw the up-tempo rise of the Islamic State, I sit also on the House Intelligence Committee. We deal with the classified secrets of the nation and also with terrorism. I asked for a private classified meeting with the FBI earlier this summer. And I asked our FBI, are there any Minnesotans that have left to fight with the Islamic State? And they told me, yes, there are 2. At that time, it was classified. Now the whole world knows. They said, there are 2 that we are watching. And I said, now, presumably, if they don't blow themselves up or if they aren't killed fighting for the Islamic State, would they be allowed to return to America if they choose to? And they said, yes, they would, because they're Americans and they have an American passport. Now, these are terrorists. These are terrorists who have taken up arms against the United States, and they would be allowed free passage to return to the United States of America. There isn't a citizen that I've spoken to that has thought that that's a good idea. I just had that confirmed again within the last 2 weeks by our FBI and Homeland Security that is how they read the law. I've read the law. It is United States Code Section 349A. As I read the law, I believe that our government would not be required to allow them to come back into the United States. But I want to make it absolutely clear. So my legislation would add another subsection that would say if an individual who is an American citizen with a U.S. passport is either affiliated with or a member of a foreign terrorist organization, U.S. designated, then the government would have the right to pull their passport and begin the process of denaturalization, stripping them of their American citizenship. In other words, they would have full due process rights, but they also wouldn't have the right to return to the United States because presumably they have battlefield experience, they have relationships with other terrorists, and potentially a plan for terrorist acts here in the United States. We know the up-tempo of the Islamic State. We know what they have stated. They stated unequivocally by their leader, Baghdadi, in January, he made this quote. He said, we will be in direct contact with you soon, meaning the United States. He said, we are with you. We are watching you. We are with you. Just recently again now, in the last month or so, he made another comment to the United States along the same lines that they intend to have activity here in the United States. No one thought they would be able to get into Baghdad. Today, mortars are going into western Baghdad, and there are Islamic State cells in Baghdad. And the question is, will Baghdad fall? I think that when a madman speaks, you listen. We need to take this threat from the Islamic State extremely seriously and recognize that we could see violent activity here in this nation as well. And that's why on every level we need to secure our borders. I am sorry to say, I don't believe that our government is fully securing our borders today. In fact, I know they aren't. Not on the southern border through illegal immigration, but certainly not from legal immigration. When an American citizen who becomes a terrorist, in my mind, they do not have a right to come and upset the safety and security of the American people. The American people deserve to have the right to feel safe in their homes and safe in their communities. And that's what my legislation is doing. And we have members of Congress who are coming on that legislation. I think it should be fast-tracked. I think when we come back into Washington, D.C., the legislation has a companion by Senator Ted Cruz in the Senate. I think that should be fast-tracked because we need to stop terrorists from coming into the United States. Yes.
Is there anyone over on the side I didn't mean to ignore you?
Okay. From the Internet? Okay.
We have one from the web, which is addressing campaign finance issues. And the fact that the Beltway seems to have so much control over who wins or loses because of the national developments in campaign financing, they propose having all donations restricted to and spending within the district from which the candidate is running. Would you care to comment?
Well, that's an interesting concept. I've never heard of that before. Okay, so if just for the benefit of the camera, the question from the Internet from an anonymous individual was all the power for who gets to be elected seems to come from Washington, D.C., because so much of the money comes from lobbyists and organizations here in Washington. And the suggestion was, how about if the only money that could be spent on a race would come from money, I assume from individuals who live in the district, right? Was that your understanding? Okay, from individuals who live in the district, because anybody could go and open up a post office box or a bank account and, you know, defeat the purpose. So that's the question. I've never heard of that idea before, but I do know in Minnesota, let me tell you how, one thing that worked pretty well for us, it may be counterintuitive, but I believe that it is ridiculous the amount of money we're spending on these elections. It's gone into the realm of the bizarre and absurd, and even for Washington, D.C. standards. Because if you look at the presidential last time, about $1 billion was spent on either side. I was told recently that we may be looking in 2016 at about $2 billion being spent on either side to elect a president of the United States. Now, why would that be? The reason why is because whoever becomes president holds the key to the world's largest ATM machine. And the people who are giving the money to elect that president want access to that ATM machine. And from my remarks, I mentioned Solyndra. That's exactly what it was. An individual organization had given money to elect Barack Obama president of the United States, and lo and behold, they get a loan of hundreds of millions of dollars, and shazam, it all goes up in smoke. Oh, too bad. It's just the taxpayers' money. It happens over and over again. In Minnesota, this is what we did. Now, maybe this is too Pollyanna, but what we did in Minnesota is we have limits on what you can spend on an election. Actual limits. When I ran for the state Senate for the very first time, I think our limit was something like $50,000. To me, as a young mom and a kitchen table homemaker, I thought $50,000 was the moon and the stars. I thought, how would I ever raise that kind of money? Today, I have the distinction of being the member of Congress who's raised more money for a House seat than any other member of Congress. I did that because I was always Nancy Pelosi's top target to defeat. I was highly motivated. I didn't want her to win. I wanted to win. And so I raised the money. People were very generous, and I raised over $13 million in a two-year election cycle. That's crazy money. That's crazy that any candidate should have to raise that kind of money. So I think the question is a great one, because money is buying influence rather than real people going to the polls. So one would be limits, like caps on how much could be spent. The other idea that I have heard in California, these may be with local elections, there was a limit as to, or there was a booklet that was sent to every person's house. And on the booklet was a list of each of the candidates by their name with their photo, and then it had basic questions and basic answers to certain issues. So people would get that in the mail, they'd have a side-by-side comparison of the candidates, and people would go and vote. Seems like a fairly rational idea. There's things that we can do, but what we are doing now isn't working. It's leading to a game of bigger and better, and we're at the point of bizarre and absurd. One thing I love about the Heritage Foundation is this is a wellspring of thought and ideas. Don't we need more of that in our politics? We need more ideas. Whose idea will win rather than whose crummy 20-second soundbite on TV is going to win? That's what we need to have more of, and there's a better way to do it. So great question.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me here today.
Thank you.
I hope not.
Ladies and gentlemen, thanks for joining us. And again, welcome to Michelle for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you, Phil. Thank you. Thank you, everyone.
Here are just a few of the comments we've recently received from our viewers.
When I don't watch C-SPAN, I miss such important things, I'll tell you. I just turned on Naomi Dorwish. I only heard a small portion before the question and answer part, which was very revealing. I don't know what the other, what she had. Well, it doesn't matter. I was horrified, and I was so glad that there's C-SPAN for the American people to let her have a voice, so we can really hear what the conservatives are like.
Watch C-SPAN for years now, quite a bit. And the usual complaint is that you're prejudiced. I don't know that you're prejudiced in each and every individual speaker, but certainly in terms of the think tanks, yet again watching, frankly, bloviating speaker on AEI, American Enterprise Institute, and what a bunch of paid mouthpieces they are for greed and militarism. So I think ought to have some balance. How about putting a group on that actually espouses stuff like democracy and peace and justice and stuff like that? Thank you.
I'm calling in regards to your comment lines. You have Republicans, Democrats, and Independents. You should have another line, a fourth line, none of the above. There are a number of citizens of this nation of voting age who are not registered to vote and who do not vote for whatever reasons they have. And they would like to make a comment, but they can't call in on any of your lines.
And continue to let us know what you think about the programs you're watching. Call us at 202-626-3400, email us at comments@cspan.org, or you can send us a tweet at C-SPAN, hashtag comments. Join the C-SPAN conversation. Like us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter.
Next, a town hall meeting in St. Louis focuses on how the news media has been covering events in Ferguson, Missouri. Then a discussion on voter ID laws and their potential impact on next month's elections. Harris Stowe State University in St. Louis recently hosted a town hall about how the media covered events in Ferguson, Missouri, following the August shooting of teenager Michael Brown. The panel discussed whether the media fueled the ensuing protests, the effects of social and national media on a local story, and media diversity. Panelists include reporters, photojournalists, a local township official who was blogging from the protest scene, and the president of the National Association of Black Journalists. This is just under 2 hours.
Good evening. Unfortunately, in Hornet Nation, we use feedback. We need feedback. So good evening. Thank you. My name is Dr. Dewan Wormack, and I currently serve as the president of Harris Stowe State University. And on behalf of our faculty, staff, and our students, we would like to welcome you here today. We're excited to partner with this program tonight. This is our fifth town hall meeting that we've sponsored here at Harris Stowe regarding the aftermath of Ferguson. I will be attending a meeting in the morning with the Regional Chamber and Emerson to talk about some systemic community socioeconomic things that need to happen to ensure we restore this community. So we're excited to partner tonight, and we're looking forward to the fruitful dialogue that will go on that will continue to have systemic impact on our community. Thank you again for being here, and we look forward to a great program.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Aja Williams, and I'm the president of the Greater St. Louis Association of Black Journalists, which is one of the partners for tonight's town hall meeting. I'm here to actually be very brief and introduce you to our moderator and get us underway. Tonight, our moderator is Mr. Bob Butler, who is the president of the National Association of Black Journalists. He flew all the way here for this event from California. He's been in the industry for more than 20 years, where he currently works as a reporter for KCBS in San Francisco. Bob was truly instrumental during the Ferguson coverage as far as being able to help journalists on the ground when journalists were arrested, such as Wes Lowry, who is not only an NABJ member, but he was the award winner for Emerging Journalist of the Year at our recent convention. He immediately released a statement on behalf of our organization and helped in any way he could in making sure journalists on the ground were having their rights protected, essentially. So I am pleased and very happy to welcome him, and I hope you all welcome him as our moderator for this evening, Mr. Bob Butler.
Thank you, Aja. We're back there kicking it. That's why I didn't hear my name. Good evening and welcome to this town hall meeting. It's on how the media covered Ferguson. It's following the shooting death of Michael Brown. It's being brought to you by the Greater St. Louis Association of Black Journalists and President Aja Williams and the National Association of Black Journalists. My name is Bob Butler. I'm a reporter at KCBS Radio in San Francisco, and I'm president of NABJ. A couple of housekeeping notes. We do have a Twitter, a hashtag. It's hashtag Ferguson Media. You can submit your questions That way they'll collect your questions up on the screen. We also have cards if you have a question. At the end, I'm going to have a couple of questions for the panel, and then we'll go to your cards. We wanted to have a mic for people to get up and ask questions, but we don't have that. So I want to introduce our panel. To your far left is Mariah Stewart. She covers the St. Louis metro area and is the Ferguson Fellow for Huffington Post. She graduated from Lindenwood University in May and started covering Ferguson like right after her graduation. She started covering the Michael Brown shooting. That's Mariah Stewart. Next to Mariah is Christopher Ave. He's the national and political editor for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch and STLtoday.com. He's been instrumental in directing coverage of the government and political ramifications of the shooting and the resulting protests in Ferguson. Christopher Ave. Next to Chris is Bill Freibogel, the director of the School of Journalism at Southern Illinois University Carbondale. Are those the Salukis? Got that right. He has had an award-winning career covering national politics and the Supreme Court. He is the publisher of the Gateway Journalism Review. Bill Freibogel. Next to Bill is Patricia Bynes, Democratic Committeewoman of the Ferguson Township. She watched some of the looting that took place that night, those nights. She has appeared on national media outlets to discuss, among other things, the clashes between police and the community. Patricia Bynes. Bradley Rayford is a freelance photographer and a student at St. Louis Community College. He is a graduate of the Greater St. Louis Association of Black Journalists Workshop for High School Students, a journalism workshop. Some of his photos have been shown on national television. Mr. Bradley Rayford. And finally, some of you all may know, Brittany Noble Jones from KMOV Channel 4 was one of the first reporters in Ferguson on August 9th. Her social media reports really drove the media coverage, not just locally, but nationally. In fact, how many followers did you have on Twitter at that time?
Yeah, at first I started with 1,500, and then...
And now how many do you have?
13,000.
Twitter does work. So I've known Brittany since she was a student member of NABJ, a student reporter at our convention in 2010 in San Diego. And I must point out she covered Ferguson while planning her wedding, which took place how many weeks ago?
Like
2 or 3 weeks ago. The wedding, by the way, I was not invited to.
You could have.
I didn't get an invitation.
You could have.
Anyways, this is your panel. We want to talk about the media coverage. We've had a lot of town hall meetings here talking about the police, talking about the city leaders, talking about voting, not voting. But what about the media? How did the media cover this? So let me ask you each, from your perspective, did the media get it right? Mariah, we'll start with you.
I feel like the media did do, they did the best that we could in the situation. Or I know I did, and a lot of the people up here did.
You were out there. I mean, you probably have seen some of the coverage of Ferguson. Did you see any of the coverage? Because you were out there for a long time, weren't you?
Yes, I did see the coverage. The only thing that I would have to say negative about media coverage is the actual attitudes toward public officials when it came to press conferences, press meetings. Some of the reporters, cameramen, were nasty. But as far as overall coverage, I think we did a decent job.
You know, Chris, you actually directed some of the coverage, not so much the coverage of Ferguson during the protests, but the results and the ramifications of that. What are you seeing?
Well, I think in many ways the jury is still out on how we covered Ferguson, because when we say Ferguson, of course, it's really shorthand for a wide and ever-growing range of issues. This wasn't just about an incident between an officer and an 18-year-old. This was certainly it was a fatal shooting. It was an incident of it may have been a crime. It was something. Then of course it was a reaction to that. But then, what happened, in my view, opened up all kinds of deeper issues of the sort of divisions in our society, and it's just fascinating the ways the reactions vary depending upon one's background. I think it's really revealed some real problems that we have, and everything from the use of the proper use of force among police to the proper way to handle when there is a protest, which is a constitutionally protected right, by the way, to assemble and to petition and to protest, all the way to the disparity in sentencing, all the way to fines, criminal fines for small legal matters. This crazy system you may not be familiar with here, but there are something like 80 different court systems in St. Louis County. It's crazy. We have the most crazy, unfocused, balkanized system of government that I've ever seen, and I've worked in five or six states. So wide variety of issues. We're doing our best to get to all of them. It's not easy, but it's certainly important.
Okay, Bill, you actually rate the media. That's, you do a journalism review. What have you written about Ferguson, the coverage of Ferguson?
Well, I'll get to that in a second, but I just want to sort of start with whatever we think about how well the media has done. It's clear that most people in St. Louis think the media has done badly. There was a survey the other day that showed about 70% of the people thought the media had made things worse rather than better. Now I wouldn't necessarily agree with the majority sentiment there. I think that some of the things that Christopher just finished pointing to are ways in which the media has really helped, and this is both the local and the national media, has really helped focus on important issues, the balkanized courts, the fines, with the arrest warrants, police use of police profiling of African American citizens, and the need for cameras on officers, video cameras on officers for accountability. So the broader, really what I think is the most important issue, which is the conversation about race, which this town never has quite actually had, I think. So those are ways in which I think the media has done well. To answer your question about what have we written about in the journalism review, some of the things, I mean, I've said in some of our stories what a great job the Post-Dispatch photographers have done. I think they have just been amazing images, and you know, they've been very brave in the way they have covered the story. I've been pretty critical of some of the parachute journalism. There was a New Republic reporter the first week went to a barbecue place in Olivet and interviewed about five white folks who had very negative feelings about African Americans, and that was her story about what was going on in St. Louis. I thought the New York Times, they had a story the first second Sunday of the coverage. I think it was called "Circle of Rage," about that St. Louis was encircled by these segregated suburbs, and they didn't really quite get things right. I mean, for example, they portrayed Ferguson as having as a segregated community, and a person I know out at Stanford actually pulled out the census statistics that showed actually Ferguson is one of the most integrated communities, if you look at the entire boundaries of the city. I thought the citizen journalists did a really good job. I don't even know if that's quite the right word. I mean, Patricia would be one of them. Antonio French had some very, very excellent posts, I thought. Of course, they all had a point of view, but they were reporting from the scene. I quoted in the Journalism Review, I quoted a young journalist whose name is Ryan Schussler, who had been working for, I think he was working for Al Jazeera America. And he was very put off by the way journalists tended to make the story about themselves. Cameramen making jokes about where Michael Brown had died. Cameramen who were yelling at people in the community to get out of the way. Chris Hayes being out of the way of their shots. Chris Hayes, the MSNBC guy, you know, out there with the people, but he's actually behind a wrought iron fence. So I thought that he had quite a number of good points there.
I'm going to go to Bradley and Brittany before, because these are the journalists. I want to hear from the journalists, and then you're going to tell us what really happened out there. Bradley.
Okay, so obviously I'm the least experienced guy up here.
Don't say that.
Not to say funny to see, but it was interesting to see a national, international story unfold before me. I have never seen so many journalists in one spot at one time. So what kind of bothered me a little bit was because we were becoming the story. And the actual story was being overshadowed by how the police were arresting journalists, how the journalists were being in the way of sometimes. And so I think that it's important from now on that we learn from this situation and learn to report the story and not become the story. I think, Bill said, there is a mixed review from citizens in the area about how the media covers locally. I do believe that the best was done with the resources they had. With any situation, things can be done differently. But the story was unfolding so at such a high pace, it was kind of hard to please everybody with the story. However, like I said, things can be done differently. So I hope this will be a learning situation, not only for the police, but also from the folks in the journalist industry to learn from this and do things differently next time.
So, Brittany, you were out there early and often.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about when you first got out and how, I mean, you were one of the first reporters on scene, right?
Well, I think it's really interesting to note, and it's really funny that Bradley and I sit here next to each other because he was my photographer that was taking my engagement pictures, and literally in the middle of the session, we're like, wait a minute. What is this going on? And my fiance was like, you are not leaving. I'm like, I think I am. And so we headed out there, and then Bradley later went out there and was taking his own pictures, and that's how we started covering the story. And I think that I think you hit it straight on. I'm not one to really pick sides or anything, but I know that it was tough for me not to stay out of it because I'm a reporter. I'm emotionally removed from situations. Any situations that I'm covering on a day-to-day basis, really. But a lot of people thought that I was trying to become the story just because I was putting out so many Instagram posts and because I was out there in the mix. And so KMOV, we're a very brand-driven station. We're always watching out for you. We're holding people accountable. We're, you know, digging for answers. We're an emotional brand. And when you put that brand into an extremely emotional, what became a very national case, now it's almost like I'm the emotional reporter. So you just have to take a look and how I had to take a look at myself and how I was covering it and how I need to step back as far as our brand I absolutely was reporting the facts, but I know how some people said, you know, reporters are trying to become the story. And don't forget, there were a lot of reporters out there that were trying to, this was their name to fame, you know, if you will. It's a huge national story. It's not just reporters. Like, I've seen vendors out on the street selling T-shirts. Like, they're trying to make a profit off of this, too. So it's just, how did media cover this? Did we get it right? I think that's such a very broad question. There's so many media outlets. I've never seen anything like it as well, Bradley. So both of us, this is the biggest story we've ever covered in our career. I can't speak to how everybody else covered it. I can only look at myself, how I covered it, what I think I did good and what I think I could improve on, and go from there.
So, Patricia, you're out there in the middle of it. You know, you're kind of doing double duty, not just as a public official, but also you were blogging about what you were seeing, the violence and all that. So when you look at the national coverage, there's always a difference between national coverage and local coverage.
Correct.
This has happened for anybody that's a reporter.
Correct.
You know that you'll be in town, and then the national media comes in and things change. So from your perspective, how do things go?
Well, I've always kind of been, a news connoisseur. I'm always reading, always keeping up on what's going on. And I tweet, I'm Patricialicious, and that's how I initially found out about the shooting. And I think because I get such a diverse view of the news, I read the local, I read the national, I look at international things. To me, it's cute to see you guys be so hard on yourselves, but there are so many types of Ferguson stories that were covered, and some of them were done well, and some of them were not. I definitely want to give kudos to the local coverage that was here, because I know, just like for myself, I had to school a lot of the national media on how St. Louis worked. They did not know that. And I know that this was a crisis situation and people just jumped in, but I would certainly hope that in the future, in a crisis situation, before national media jumps in, they have to do some homework so that way they can start getting the story right. Because initially I saw posts and I was like, oh, no, you don't understand. We had to explain government municipalities. They got Ferguson police and St. Louis County police mixed up. And it's a huge difference in what was going on, and it changed the entire tone of the story. And as Ferguson, and it's continuing to unfold, the coverage is not over. And as it continues to go on, you can tell which news organizations and which reporters were trying to get it right, who was actually doing the homework, who was asking the hard questions and doing the deep digging. And as far as the reporters becoming the story, I think that there may have been some people trying to become the story, but I think an important part of the Ferguson story is the violation of First Amendment rights, that if they don't care about how they treat the media, imagine what they're doing to the people that actually live here. So what is considered being in the way to the police versus to the media versus to the people? And I think that that was important. Yeah, please lock up some national reporters and have them talk about that experience, just so that way they can get a taste of what dealing with St. Louis County and Ferguson police is really like. So there may have been some people who injected themselves, but what has come out of it is this real eye-opening experience to, whoa, what is going on down there? If they're doing this to us, what's it like to live there? And then once they started really trying to dig to see, what is all this anger all about? And it became not just the shooting of a young man and leaving his body out in the middle of the street for 4.5 hours. It became the understanding of police harassment, the ticketing. So where's the ticketing come from? The courts. I mean, just everything just kept rolling out. All of St. Louis's dirty laundry just came out for everyone to see, because none of this was new to anybody who lived here.
So from what I hear you say is that we should not have been surprised that reporters were arrested. Is that what I'm hearing you saying?
That's exactly what I'm saying.
Is that common? Are the police that, I don't want to say bad, but I mean, I've covered protests for years. I've never been arrested, never even been threatened with arrest. I mean, one time a police officer came at me, but he saw my microphone with the mic bug on it, and I think that would save me. But I was, when I heard about reporters being arrested, I'm like, what? Mm-hmm. You know, what for? And so you're saying it's not a surprise.
No, they're quite brazen and don't appreciate any pushback to their authority. And that's certainly how we feel, you know, in the streets. So you guys get a dose of what it's like and see for yourself.
Bradley, you said something?
I was surprised that reporters were getting arrested. I was very surprised. I even knew some of the reporters that got arrested, and it took me back. Like, I'm turning on the news, I'm like, what happened to you? You know, it took me back.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think just like with this, I think the original story uncovered a lot of more deeper stories. Not only was this kid shot by a police officer, unarmed kid shot by a police officer, now you have the response of police towards the citizens that pays their salary. Now you have the response towards the police, that towards media members that cover the stories. Now you uncover the racial wounds that St. Louis has. So this story has uncovered so many more stories beyond what happened to Mike Brown. But now we have other stuff to deal with because of Mike Brown.
Do you think, I've done this before, I've mentioned this before, that the media sometimes drives the protests. They might be sitting around not doing anything, but a TV camera shows up or a microphone shows up and people start going crazy. Do you think the media contributed to that in Ferguson? Anybody?
Well, I think the night that Thomas the Tank Engine showed up in the middle of it selling something, and a local well-known homeless advocate and minister showed up to raise money, and I'm not sure the T-shirts that were being sold. Yeah, absolutely. There were a lot of people trying to manipulate the media. And, you know, we in the media, I think we can all agree on this, we hate being part of the story. Mm-hmm. It is not why we're there. That is not the goal. And even the thought that we would be part of a story is just makes us extremely uncomfortable. But the phenomenon that you describe is undoubtedly accurate, and it will continue to be accurate. People will see the camera or the notebook or the microphone, and they will act in a way that they would not otherwise have acted, and that's unfortunate.
You know, I agree with Christopher that in general reporters don't like to be the center of the story, but I have to admit that I had the same reaction that I think Bradley was describing earlier, that sometimes the reporters were really happy to make themselves part of the story. I was a little bit. The day that those two guys were arrested in the McDonald's, I had really divided feelings, because on the one hand, I felt as though this police, in general, that at that point, in the way they were handling the protests and the way they were handling reporters, were violating the First Amendment. On the other hand, I felt as though those, you know, when I looked at the Huffington Post and the World War III headlines about these two guys getting arrested after they basically refused to vacate the McDonald's on police orders, you know, suddenly the story was about those guys, and I was not. I found that sort of offensive, to be honest with you. It seemed like it was at that point that the story took off. I mean, the story should have taken off for what it said about race in St. Louis, not what it said about a couple of reporters who got themselves arrested at a McDonald's.
Any questions from the audience? You can tweet to at Ferguson Media, and we'll pick up the questions on the screen. And I believe there are some cards. Who has the cards for questions? Say it again. Oh, a pound, yeah. I just showed my age, didn't I?
There's one there.
We have a question? So we talked about national versus local media. How much do you think this would have been, how much less of violence do you think it would have been had it just been the local media? Do you think the national media drives this? Because, you know, when the big boys show up, as they say, now you've got the big trucks, the cameras, you got, you know, all the fixers and everything. Pat?
It was local at first. Everything was local. And what got the national media's attention was social media. Right. That's where your stories are. That's where it came from. So to see the tweets and the pictures and the videos that were out there, you can't help but be like, oh, my gosh, what's going on? So I'll tell you, the local media was out there. They came out there. They were live streaming what was going on at night, the reporters and the photojournalists. We were all out there running together, and it was amazing. But the local was there first, and then it was the response from social media. That's what got it big.
And let's not forget that, you know, what tipped me off even about this story, because I wasn't at work when I found out about the...
She just left.
The death of Mike Brown. But it was social media. It was not reporters. It was people that had seen these images all over Instagram or all over Twitter, and they're asking what the story was. So it's really not just the local media that started this whole thing. It's really how social media really took a part in the story. People were instantly sharing this. The word got out so quickly. The news hadn't even come on yet.
Mm-hmm. I believe that picture of Mike Brown laying on the ground with the blood streaming down the street.
Yep. And then the dad. Remember
and then
the dad
with the sign that said, "My son was executed by the Ferguson Police Department." Those two pictures were shared thousands of times within that time span of a couple hours. And so you have You cannot miss that. You, no matter who you are, you couldn't miss that. You knew somebody that knew somebody that shared this picture, so it's going to be on your news feed on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. So you could not avoid seeing those pictures. So that the fact that those pictures were out there kind of made the story bigger than what it is now.
And then even just the video, I mean, even while reporters possibly were sleeping, if we did sleep, there were other people that just lived in the neighborhood that were out that are still on Instagram, they're still on Facebook, and they're still capturing these moments that we missed while we were sleeping. So I don't know that it's all just, I mean, local media did their best to try to cover the story, but I think that people in that area in St. Louis really just quickly picked up on it and just shared it with the world.
Chris, have we seen a shift? Because remember, there used to be a time when there was a big story, it'd be on page one. On, you know,
the next day.
The next day.
Yeah.
And that's why I like working on radio, because I can cover the same story you covered. I can go on the air, like, immediately with my telephone.
Yep.
But are we seeing a shift? Because no longer do you have to wait till the next day.